Lecture 13, Black Culture and Resistance in the South.
In 1819, an elderly slaveholder on the verge of death summoned an enslaved man named Cato to his bedside. Cato was considered to be the most valued and cherished enslaved person on the plantation, and he was widely known to be the old slaveholder's favorite. But the feelings were not reciprocated. According to a popularly circulated story, the old man tried to give Cato a special honor before the slaveholder died, but it turned out to be an offer that Cato firmly rejected. "I intend, Cato," the enslaver said, "to allow you to be buried in the family vault." For the old man, this was the highest honor he could imagine. He was granting Cato, an enslaved black man, the right to be buried alongside his white elite owners, as if Cato was a member of the family. But Cato had a different view of the matter. "I don't think I like that," Cato replied. "Suppose we get buried together and the devil comes looking for you. In the dark, he might take away a poor black man by mistake." For Cato, the situation was clear. While the slaveholder cherished and adored Cato, Cato viewed the elderly white man as nothing more than a wicked soul, guilty of enslaving dozens of people who longed for freedom. Because of these immoral crimes, Cato believed that his owner was destined for eternal damnation. So did thousands of other enslaved people who passed this humorous tale throughout their communities. For them, it served as an inspiring reminder that enslavers were destined for hell, and enslaved people would find everlasting salvation in heaven. It would be easy to dismiss this scene as a silly, meaningless, albeit ironic, encounter. But we should not be so quick to do so, because this story gives us powerful insight into enslaved people's mindset. First, it clearly shows that white enslavers and black enslaved people often had radically different views about their relationships and interactions with each other. In this case, the elderly slaveholder believed that Cato was a trusted, loyal servant who could practically be considered a member of the family. But for Cato, the white man who held him in slavery and literally owned him would never be more than an evil spirit bound for hell. This story also demonstrates how enslaved people drew upon their spiritual beliefs and even humor to cope with their lives in bondage. Cato's insistence that the old man was doomed to eternal suffering proved that many enslaved people clung to the hope that their earthly suffering would be rewarded in the afterlife, while their tormentors would be forever damned. Building upon Cato's example, this lecture explores a fascinating and complex question. How did enslaved people draw on culture and spirituality to cope with the horrors of slavery? This session seeks to answer that question by examining how enslaved people resisted against slavery socially and culturally. So, what do I mean by social resistance? How does a person resist socially? In this case, I'm referring to the ways that enslaved people created meaningful lives, despite how slavery tried to strip them of their humanity. As we'll see, enslaved people created alternative conceptions of family, cultivated liberatory notions of Christianity, and even creatively used humor and music to battle against slavery's efforts to dehumanize them. So let's begin with the most salient aspects of human life, family and community. Undoubtedly, enslaved families faced the cruel and habitual reality of sale and separation. But it's also true that enslaved people fought valiantly to retain and maintain their biological families as much as possible. Both during and after the era of enslavement, enslaved people sometimes managed to establish long-lasting marriages and two-parent households, despite the constant threat of sale. In such situations, enslaved families looked much like nuclear families today. but in most cases, the nature of slavery demanded the creation of alternative family structures. Often, enslaved spouses lived on different plantations, which meant that enslaved men could only see their wives and children sporadically. In other cases, multiple generations lived within the same dwelling in family units that contained siblings, aunts, uncles, and grandparents living together in the same household. While these family structures didn't represent a typical contemporary nuclear family, enslaved people still managed to have monogamous marriages and meaningful family experiences. To be sure, Black families were not acknowledged or protected by law. They only existed at the plantation owner's whim. And yet, enslaved people's desires to create and defend their immediate and extended families attest to the powerful importance they placed on family relationships, despite their conditions. One image from the Civil War era depicts five generations of an enslaved family on a plantation in South Carolina, a testament to enslaved people's enduring hopes to maintain stable family units. But we know that such opportunities were extremely rare. Instead, as the institution of slavery rapidly expanded in the early 19th century, enslaved people were routinely bought and sold across the Upper and Deep South as enslavers sought to gain more laborers and raise capital. Despite their best efforts, most enslaved people could not expect to live within their biological family unit throughout their lives. In fact, they and their family members were typically sold multiple times during their lives, sometimes across long distances. Once sold away, many enslaved people never saw their biological family members again. So, given these circumstances, how did enslaved people manage to sustain notions of family and community? We now know that enslaved people socially resisted slavery by creating new, alternative conceptions of family. As I mentioned a few moments ago, Black nuclear families were not protected by legal or moral rights during enslavement. Instead, most enslaved people were torn from their biological families through sale or punishment. In the absence of reliable biological family units, enslaved people formed what later became known as fictive kin networks. In recent years, sociologists have created this term, fictive kin, to describe a type of family relationship that develops between people who have no actual biological or marital connection. In other words, fictive kin are people who interact as siblings, parent and child, aunt or uncle, even though they are not actually related by blood or marriage. As you might imagine, forging fictive kinship was a vital and essential component of coping with slavery. Given the frequency of sale, enslaved people had to build and rebuild family connections as they moved from place to place. Fictive kinship was particularly important in the worst of situations, when your own siblings or parents were sold away from you, or when you were sold and found yourself in an entirely foreign environment surrounded by strangers. The notion that anyone in your immediate environment or community could potentially become siblings, parents, or children to you, provided a social world that eased the horror and terror of enslavement. Only by forging new family and community connections could enslaved people hope to create meaningful, loving lives in the midst of slavery. Interestingly, fictive kin networks also resuscitated and revitalized the importance of kinship in West Africa that we discussed at the very beginning of this course. Among most ethnic groups in West Africa, village and ethnic identities were extremely important, and their kinship networks and lineage were vital to how they lived. Although notions of kinship could no longer be based solely on biological or blood relationships, enslaved people could still understand themselves as part of a broader kin or family structure that brought identity, purpose, and love into their lives, despite their inhumane conditions. Beyond conceptions of family and community, enslaved people also resisted against slavery through religious worship. Particularly by the 19th century, they found ways to use Christianity as a tool for envisioning freedom and liberation. As we've previously discussed, conversion to Christianity was not immediate or instantaneous. In fact, it took multiple generations for Christianity to fully take root in Black communities, partly because slaveholders initially discouraged conversion, and partly because African people held tightly to their own spiritual beliefs. But slowly, these cultural patterns began to shift. And once Christianity spread through enslaved communities, it took on an entirely new meaning and purpose. A few factors influenced this dramatic religious change. The first was a movement that swept across the United States beginning in the late 1790s and early 1800s. Later known as the Second Great Awakening, this religious movement encouraged mass conversion to Christianity across racial lines. Much like the First Great Awakening that inspired the American Revolution, this second wave of religious fervor used enthusiasm, emotion, and appeals to the supernatural to attract large crowds. The Second Great Awakening particularly took root in the North, especially New York and Ohio. But it also spread rapidly across the South, especially in the coastal regions of Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. As both white and Black people increasingly embraced Christianity, many plantation owners allowed enslaved people to practice religion and engage in public worship. In fact, some plantation owners began to manipulate Christianity, hoping that religious devotion could operate as a form of social control. They believed that if they emphasized only certain aspects of the Bible, they could reinforce the idea that Black people were intended to be enslaved, and that servants had a moral duty to be obedient to their masters. Throughout the South, enslavers began selectively using biblical stories to encourage deference, docility, and submission from the enslaved community. In some cases, they even allowed enslaved people to become preachers, hoping that it would encourage Black people to embrace the message and accept their condition in life more readily. What slaveholders did not expect was that enslaved people gradually embraced and accepted Christianity on their own terms, molding it into a religious system they could believe in. In so doing, enslaved people created a form of religion and worship that white people did not know about and could not control. Historians refer to slave religion as the invisible institution because the actual worshiping usually happened in secret without the plantation owner's knowledge. Certainly, some plantations held large public religious gatherings that white enslavers and overseers would observe. But later, unbeknownst to white people, enslaved men, women, and children would gather in secret, often in the surrounding woods or swamps. There, in hidden places often referred to as hush harbors, enslaved people held clandestine religious ceremonies, celebrating aspects of Christianity that resonated with their experience. In these secret meetings, enslaved people created an entirely different interpretation of Christianity, what is now called liberation theology. Black liberation theology was based on two main ideas, both of which emphasized Black people's eventual triumph over slavery. First, enslaved people focused on the story of Exodus and the Israelites' flight from bondage. Convinced that the Israelites' salvation demonstrated God's opposition to slavery, enslaved people clung to the vision that, like the Hebrews, they would one day be delivered from slavery. Liberation theology also promised spiritual redemption after earthly suffering. According to this philosophy, enslaved people might face unspeakable horrors in the earthly realm, but their sacrifice would be rewarded in the afterlife. Cato, the enslaved man whose story opened this session, is an excellent example. In Cato's spiritual worldview, enslaved people might experience inequality or brutality in this life, but the afterlife promised much more. Black people were destined to heaven, while cruel slaveholders would be subjected to eternal damnation. Therefore, slave religion, and more specifically Black liberation theology, provided an important tool for survival and resistance during slavery. It gave enslaved people hope, courage, and faith that their misery would eventually cease, that God would free them from bondage, and upon their death, they would be rewarded in heaven. Despite Christianity's powerful influence in enslaved communities, it's important to keep in mind that most enslaved people remained connected to West African spiritual beliefs. Employing a method that sociologists call syncretism, enslaved people strategically blended West African rituals, practices, and beliefs with Christianity. For example, as they had since the colonial era, many enslaved people relied on conjurmen, or African spiritual practitioners, to provide them with amulets, talismans, or other potions to ward off evil spirits. In his world-famous autobiography, Black abolitionist Frederick Douglass described how he carried a packet of herbs and a talisman in his pocket to protect him from harm and violence from an overseer. The talisman had been given to him by an enslaved man named Sandy, who had recently arrived from Africa and was a practitioner of African spirituality. Even though Douglass identified as a Christian, he never forgot that gift, and he credited the talisman for helping him escape from slavery. After all, it was only while carrying that talisman that Douglass triumphed over a brutal overseer and eventually gained his freedom. Another popular and beautiful ritual that survived in the Americas was the use of bottle trees. Drawing upon a spiritual practice from the Congo region of West Central Africa, Black people protected themselves against evil spirits by placing bottles upside down on tree branches near their homes. They believed that evil spirits would be attracted to the glittering bottles and get trapped inside. They would remain stuck there until the next morning when new daylight shined on the bottle and destroyed the evil spirit. Throughout the slavery era, then, Black folks illuminated the South with glittering bottle trees because even those who espoused Christianity continued to use this strategy to guard and defend against bad spirits. Bottle trees still exist in the United States today, even though minor aspects of their appearance have changed. Traditionally, enslaved people used blue bottles, since they believed that ghosts and spirits were drawn to the color blue. They also tried to use crepe myrtle trees whenever possible, likely because such trees were associated with emancipation in the Bible. Following emancipation, customs shifted slightly, as Black people began using multiple types of bottles and trees. But even now, bottle trees can still be found across much of the Deep South. Syncretic or blended cultural practices could be seen in many aspects of Black religious practice in the 19th century. In fact, Christian worship in Black communities was infused with African culture, ranging from boisterous, enthusiastic prayer to infectious, dynamic music and dance. African cultural influences could even be seen in burial rituals. Well into the 20th century, Black people incorporated West African practices into their burial rites. These included shrouding the dead in cloth before placing them in coffins, burying people with their most treasured possessions, and decorating graves with shells, pottery, and stones. But perhaps the most famous example of African cultural influences on Christian worship is evident in a practice known as call and response. Still prevalent in Black churches today, call and response incorporates a West African ethic of community engagement and participation. In many African cultures, religious worship is not a silent, passive experience in which the preacher delivers a sermon to a quiet, unresponsive audience. Instead, it's an exciting, enthusiastic, dynamic process in which the audience and preacher interact with each other throughout the sermon, with the audience urging and inspiring the preacher to deliver a powerful message. The most common example of call and response would be when the preacher issues a particularly powerful statement and then says, "Brothers and sisters, can I get an amen?" And the congregation responds, "Amen." Through that exchange, the preacher checks in and seeks an affirmation from his listeners, and only continues once the affirmation is given from the congregation. Using modes of worship such as call and response, enslaved and free Black communities were able to retain aspects of their own cultural values and norms, while still embracing a liberatory Christian ethic. So far, we've discussed family, community, and religion. But over the past several decades, historians have uncovered overwhelming evidence of how enslaved people combined social and cultural resistance in daily forms of resistance against slavery. So for the remainder of this session, we'll turn our attention to daily resistance. Unlike running away or engaging in rebellion, daily resistance refers to a wide variety of strategies that enslaved people used to fight back against their condition in large and small ways. These methods included talking back, deceiving the master or overseer, avoiding work, and even lobbying or negotiating for improved conditions. One social and psychological method has become known as the mask. This was a clever and unique strategy in which enslaved people wore a social mask, meaning that they behaved one way in front of white people and only revealed their true selves around other Black people. In most cases, that meant that they tricked white people into believing that they accepted slavery, but privately, they rebelled. Here again, Cato's story, which opened this session, is instructive. In the mind of the old slaveholder, Cato was a trusted, beloved, and loyal member of his imagined family, so much so that the elderly man wanted Cato buried alongside him in the family plot. In other words, Cato wore an effective social mask in front of his master and successfully duped the slaveholder into believing he was a devoted, faithful slave. But at the old man's deathbed, Cato finally revealed his true feelings. For Cato, the man who owned him and held him in bondage was nothing more than an evil soul destined for hell. Cato was not alone. Slaveholders' letters, journals, and plantation records are full of similar stories, a shocking pattern in which a master or mistress believed they had a special relationship with a particular enslaved person, only to discover that their trusted, loyal servant was secretly rebelling against them. As we'll see in our next session, for example, fugitives rarely gave an indication of their discontent before they fled. Instead, enslavers and overseers were left stunned when they learned that their most loyal slave had run off. This pattern was particularly apparent among enslaved people who worked in the house, since they had regular and constant interaction with the slaveholding family members. Like Cato's owner, these folks often believed that the people they owned deeply cared for them. In reality, enslaved people only sought their own freedom. Enslaved women who worked in the house were especially well located to effectively fool their owners, and they often used their position to sabotage the plantation. Most often, they resorted to secret attacks using poison or arson. In fact, enslaved cooks routinely attempted to poison their owners using ground-up glass or deadly weeds in the food. Another story I often tell my students centers on an enslaved woman named Suki, who vexed and irritated her enslavers to no end. Much like Cato, Suki's master believed she was loyal and trustworthy. But in her case, Suki's master also believed that she was painfully ignorant. He complained for months in his journal about his efforts to teach Suki how to build fires in the fireplace. Each time he tried, he would later find her setting fire to the curtains, the walls, or other parts of the house. It never occurred to him that Suki was intentionally setting those fires to burn down the house and secure her freedom. While some enslaved people like Suki used direct methods to end their enslavement, others resorted to creative manipulation. If nothing else, enslaved people clearly understood that their labor was valuable and brought the plantation owner tremendous profit. So they used numerous methods to creatively avoid work. In so doing, they not only lessened their own burden, They also deprived slaveholders of the thing they valued most. Enslaved people used a variety of work avoidance strategies, including working slowly, breaking tools, faking illness, and, like Suki, faking stupidity. Perhaps the most common and effective form of work avoidance was simply working as slowly as possible. Certainly, such behavior could result in violent punishment, but many enslaved people struck a careful balance, appearing to work hard while actually producing as little as they could. One white visitor from the North noticed this behavior and remarked, "There is an element of resistance to white society in the shambling, sullenly slow pace of the Negro. It is the gesture of a man who is forced to work for ends not his own, and who expresses his reluctance to perform under these circumstances." Another way to avoid work was to purposely sabotage tools or equipment. This problem became so common that doctors began to believe it was a medical ailment. One Southern doctor wrote extensively about this disease, which he alleged caused destructive behavior. Enslaved people, he claimed, break, waste, and destroy everything they handle, abuse horses and cattle, tear or burn or rend their own clothing, and paying no attention to the rights of property, steal others to replace what they have destroyed. They wander about at night and keep in a half-nodding sleep during the day. They slight their work as if for pure mischief. It's certainly possible that tools were cheaply made and prone to breakage, or that such problems were simply accidental. But given the frequency and omnipresent nature of such problems, and the level of annoyance they caused among plantation owners and overseers, we must at least consider that such equipment damage was an intentional plot to avoid exhausting, tedious, and forced labor. Especially when considered alongside other work avoidance techniques, such as faking illness or stupidity. One Northern visitor, for example, described a plantation where he encountered a group of enslaved people who had been relieved of work duty because they were allegedly sick. But when the visitor suddenly approached, the enslaved people showed no outward signs of illness. Instead, as he later wrote, they were reclining on the doorsteps or on the ground, basking in the sunshine, and they were all chatting and laughing as I rode up. Work avoidance also manifested as feigning stupidity or behaving erratically to trick the enslavers. One enslaved woman named Dinah avoided work by convincing her mistress that she was crazy. When her mistress tried to tell her to work, Dinah would reply with a laugh and scream out, "I won't, catch me if you can," and then she would take to her heels and run away. Dinah's mistress thought she was so crazy that she eventually just left her alone. As one last example, I want to highlight how enslaved people worked collectively to deceive overseers and plantation owners. Certainly, people fought slavery individually, but they also collaborated to defy a system that oppressed them all. Such collective action was particularly possible when plantations used drivers rather than white overseers to enforce labor routines. As we've discussed, sometimes plantation owners used enslaved people known as drivers instead of white overseers. Like overseers, black drivers were expected to push their fellow enslaved people to work harder and harder. And yet sometimes, drivers creatively protected their brothers and sisters. One former driver later described how he learned to manipulate the whip to make it appear as if he was lashing the workers. But in fact, he was not touching them. As he explained, if the master or overseer was approaching, I would commence to plying the lash vigorously, when, according to arrangement, they would squirm and screech as if in agony, although not one of them had in fact been grazed. Such stories demonstrate how notions of community, collaboration, and clever strategy often converge to help enslaved people defy and survive their enslavement. In this session, we've delved into various forms of resistance. But before I close, I do want to point out that given the atrocities during slavery, sometimes simply surviving was a powerful strike against slavery. At its core, slavery was an institution designed to break the will, the spirit, and the humanity of enslaved people. So every day, when people survived, endured, and refused to be dehumanized, they were successfully fighting against their enslavement. For this reason, dance, music, humor, storytelling, and building community were powerfully important. Because every time an enslaved person sang, danced, played the banjo or drum, encouraged each other to laugh, or loved each other, they defied slavery itself. In our next session, we'll discuss an even more dramatic response to enslavement: armed rebellion.